The NFL playoffs march on. Wildcard weekend brought dominant performances from Seattle and Pittsburgh. The Texans get a slightly better Brock Osweiler, and Aaron Rodgers is absolutely unstoppable. All that, plus very little talk about boats and boating trips on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. We are through Wild Card Weekend, and it was a weekend full of face masks. Lots of grabbing of the face mask. That was my takeaway.
Well, listen to our here, listeners. We're going to give you a good show, but these were not good games. They were terrible games. This was the worst Wild Card Weekend I've ever seen. Don't let that impact the show. We're still going to talk football. We'll make it interesting. We'll get into the nuts and bolts of it. But I felt like I don't want to humble brag. I felt like I knew what was going to happen though in every game. Like every team played exactly the way they played all season long. There was no change up. It was remarkable the consistency and the approach to the game. And it played out very predictably because of that, I felt.
Yeah, you know, I think that Packers Giants game had a chance. We're going to start with that one. And as always, we will have the look ahead show on Thursday where we break down all of the upcoming matchups. So we will focus on the weekend games. We will talk a little bit about the losing teams this week, since this is the last time we will address them during the season, and sort of what they are looking at during the offseason. But let's go. Let's go with topic one here.
Number one.
And this was the Packers' victory over the Giants in Lambeau. This one surprised me. I thought this was the game that was going to be close, that sort of could go either way. And obviously the difference ended up having a lot to do with boats and boat related things. And, if you're a boatsman, you're really going to like this show, because it's going to be boat talk for like 45 minutes.
South Florida boats is what you're talking about. Miami
yes.
boats. I'm with you. This was the one I didn't get this one. This was the one that I guess did go a little bit against what I would have foreseen, although the way the Packers did it is exactly the way you would have guessed they would have done it. I didn't think they'd be able to be that prolific in the second half against the Giants. I think the Dominique Rodgers Cromartie injury, I think it did factor, and probably in ways that we don't necessarily see. Troy Aikman kept beating around the bush, but he was very deliberate in his strikes around the bush, that they had some blitz designs, unique ones, brand new ones, ready for this game. And if mm-hmm. Rodgers Cromartie goes out and you lose the confidence of the slot coverage, meaning you're not a lockdown slot coverage team now, then those blitzes get compromised. And I would almost guarantee you Aikman got that information from Steve Spagnuolo, because there was a certainty to him. The way he was saying that, it's probably a production meeting thing that came up. And Spagnuolo's an open guy. He would tell Aikman that and trust Aikman in that regard. So I think the injury did factor, and Green Bay was a better version of themselves than I would have guessed. But approach-wise, it was very similar to what Green Bay did against the Giants in the first matchup. The biggest factor in this game was that New York's four-man pass rush did absolutely nothing against Green Bay's offensive line.
Yep. Obviously no Jason Pierre-Paul, and we'll deep dive the Giants just a little bit in the next topic. But yeah, you know, that Rodgers Cromartie injury, the middle of the field opened up. I mean, they picked on Trevin Wade, they picked on Cody Sensabaugh. That kind of, you know, every sort of key third down play seemed to come off those slot guys, and whether it was Cobb in there or Adams rotated in there a little bit. But first half, this was a rough first half for the Packers. I mean, they basically, you know, Rodgers dropped that nice pass on the sideline to Devontae Adams over Eli Apple. That was a nice play right there. But other than that, it was kind of like there's the Hail Mary, and then that was kind of it.
Yeah, and keep in mind, Rogers Cromartie went out on the second play. So that
Yeah.
first half where they were doing well, Saint-Sabah and Trevin Wade, who have been fine as fill-in guys, as the number four corners, at times number three corners this year if other guys were hurt, I don't think they were horrible in this game. But I think what happens is when you have an average corner in there rather than a star like Rogers Cromartie, then you call the game differently if you're
Yep.
Spagnuolo. But a lot of the passes, and those guys weren't great in the slot, certainly. Certainly, but a lot of the passes they gave up came late in the down. What was it? The Adams 5-yard touchdown was the best example.
Yeah.
Where Saint-Sabah had, I mean, Saint-Sabah had perfect man
Yep.
coverage, I believe. And yeah, for that was like for 7 seconds long, he had perfect man coverage, and Rodgers made a perfect throw, and the pass protection was perfect, and that's two offensive perfects versus one defensive perfect, I guess. It was just so if we're going to talk Giants, I guess we'll save it for the next item. But to me, it's very apparent some of the things they need to do to be a better team next season.
Yeah. Offensively, obviously, they just, they never got anything going, and this was a Packers secondary that was shorthanded. And I don't know. I mean, it looked like they sort of went with a few more man beaters early. I thought a very telling play was they ran that. I think it was like a 3rd and 4 inside the 10. It was when they got their first chip shot field goal that opened the scoring, and they ran a little pick play for Sterling Shepard. And the thing was just it was messy. I mean, the timing was off. It was throw wasn't great. Shepard maybe could have hung on to it, but it was it looked like a team that had never run such a play.
Yeah, they were a fragmented offense, and they had drop passes when the concepts did work. And their best wide receiver had a number of those drops. Some of them were Beckham standard drops, meaning if we're holding him to his standard, it was a drop. They weren't the easiest of catches. And people are going to talk about the boat thing. I'm sure that's a dominant topic and will probably be at hand on Monday and maybe even on into Tuesday. And anyone that says, "Oh, the boat party caused this," or Beckham, nobody knows that. I mean, that's all guessing. But we will say this: Beckham played a poor game at times. He was double teamed in ways I've never seen. They did at one point they did the Superman double team on him, which was just two press corners. They brought up, I believe it was Bryce, the safety, and pressed him with Gunter. It was on third down where their double teams were really aggressive. And I've seen that happen in the red zone to Calvin Johnson and I think Tony Gonzalez years ago. But usually that's when those guys are split out by themselves, so you can kind of have the field space to play that. This was a regular 2x2 formation, and they did a double press coverage against him. So Beckham drew a lot of attention, so nobody would make catches against that. But I think the play that was also indicative of an offense not clicking in a receiving core and a star receiver not playing well, and it was an innocuous looking play, but it was a first down and 10 incompletion to Beckham where Gunter blitzed off of the cornerback spot. So Beckham was in a tighter split, so Gunter had less room to blitz. So he was in a good position to blitz, and Beckham was late converting his hot route, and so it looked like Manning threw behind him and it was a bad throw. Beckham did not identify the hot route, and if you don't identify that you're supposed to run a hot route when the guy who's in press position right in front of you blitzes, then something is off mentally there in your game on that play.
Boats, boats, boats.
Oh, it was the boat. It was absolutely. Look, we don't
I
know,
can't.
but Beckham did not look into the. There were plays where he did not look like himself. That's all we know.
We joke, but look, I go into the office on Mondays and I usually drive in, which means I'll listen to our show, but I have 4 hours of driving to do. So our show only takes about an hour, and I usually just flip on WFAN, which is a local station here in New York, and oh my God. The number of times that they will say boat tomorrow will just make your head explode.
Well, it was the whole receiving corps too. Let's keep that in mind. It's getting labeled as Beckham, but a lot of other guys did it, and I haven't been on a football team before, so I don't know how I would feel about it if my teammates did it. I don't think I would do it, but again, we don't know how it correlated. We really don't. No, of course we don't.
Well, I thought this one would have been interesting had Rogers Cromartie stuck around. I do think that was a that was sort of the fissure that sort of turned into the giant crack as the game went on. And look, can't give Aaron Rodgers that, I don't know, that large a margin of error to work with. So
right, and keep in mind, Green Bay lost their best receiver too, so it was a little bit of an eye for an eye. But the difference, if we're to believe what Aikman was hinting at, and I do believe him, that they lost some of their blitz packages because Cromartie went out, Rodgers Cromartie, then the Giants had to change the way they played with Rodgers Cromartie's absence. I don't think Green Bay had to totally adjust their approach to the game in Nelson's absence. It was kind of more of a next man up, and it was Geronimo Allison was the next man up, and they continued to operate.
Yep, and it helped to have Randall Cobb back, and he looked to be at full speed. And yeah, that was the point. I had heard from a lot of people saying, oh, you know, you're saying Jordy Nelson is not as good a player as Rodgers Cromartie, and it's like, no, they're both really good players, but one was more expendable than the other one in this game. And
within the context, you know, of the game and the approach, it's not apples to apples necessarily, even though I said it was an eye for an eye. It's eye for eye, but it's certainly not an apple, Gary.
It's two very different eyes.
Yes.
We'll say that. All right. Well, the Packers will go on and play in Dallas on Sunday, 4:40 p.m. We will have the full deep dive of that one on the Thursday Look Ahead podcast, so you will have to tune into that one.
Number two.
Right now, let's go into topic two, and that is the Giants and what becomes of the New York Giants. Now, I would open with this question, Andy. We sort of look at the Giants offense all season, and you know, they have Eli and they have Beckham. There's not a whole lot of overwhelming talent outside of that. You have a couple of, you know, decent pieces. They're okay on the interior line. Sterling Shepard's going to be a good player, et cetera, et cetera. But should they go forward with this system, or should Ben McAdoo be looking to make some sort of, if not necessarily drastic change, make some significant alterations to what they do?
It depends. I think it depends what they have at tight end once the offseason concludes. If they can find a difference-making tight end, someone who's a mismatch problem, who's more consistent, and Ty's not the guy. I know. He gets painted as an up-and-comer sometimes, just like Larry Donnell did. What it is they get the ball thrown to him on national TV games because everyone's leaving them single-covered and worrying about the wide receivers. And it's 50-50 whether those guys make the play each week. If they had a threatening tight end, I think they can give this system another year as it is. Maybe you certainly want to always be tweaking and expanding and evolving. If they don't have that, if they have the same personnel as next year, then they do need to evolve and add to what they do. And their running game is very predictable, and it's easy to criticize that, but if the passing game is not threatening, then the predictable running game does become the issue. But I think they need to get better. Well, go ahead. I think they need to get better in the middle of the field, though, to answer your question.
Yeah. I mean, I would ask, as far as the running game goes, you know, a lot of people are saying, oh, look at this, you know, 70 yards rushing today, or you know, sort of citing the stats on that. I mean, how good a back do you need back there to be able to make this a threatening running game, you know, with the design of this offense? Because it seems like, you know, unless you have a young Adrian Peterson, unless you can get your hands on, you know, Leonard Fournette in the draft or something, it really doesn't. You know, it doesn't matter how greatly you upgrade over, let's say, Paul Perkins.
Yeah, I don't think it's a running back issue, and I don't think it's a run blocking issue. I think it's the design of the offense. When you are a single back offense and you run out of three wide receivers a lot, you get good spacing. You can lighten the box that way, and that's what I like about it. And so maybe there you're counting on your blockers to win, but you also are very limited in the number of plays you can draw up. They basically run two plays, inside zone or power, and that's the extent of their running game. So, and maybe that's because they don't have a speedy back that can turn the corner. So if you can get a speedy running back, you can run sweeps. But that's about it. They don't have the type of line that's going to run outside zone. And they don't. It goes back to tight end. Their tight ends are not good blockers either. So not only are they not threatening receivers, but you're not comfortable making them focal points in the run blocking game. So you don't see them play fullback at times. You don't see a lot of two tight end sets. They're just weak at that position.
Yeah.
And that hurts their running game. That now they're schematically limited with their ground game because of it.
Yeah. Well, the good news for the Giants is, draft-wise, this is the year of the tight end. Tight ends are back in vogue. There are plenty of guys who you'd consider in the top 75 or so picks, even with the Jake Butt injury. So they should be able to address that position, at least from a developmental standpoint. One other question, Andy, do you worry about this pass rush considering what happened today, or do you sort of say, you know, once they get all the three corners back and can do what they want, they can generate that pass rush through the blitz?
I think you can go with that second option, but if they stumble up, if there's a pass rusher they like and it's the third round and say there's some guy with character issues who could have been a late first rounder or something like that, I'd pull the trigger on that because they could use an infusion of talent there. It's not a good four-man pass rush, but they got away with that in the second half of the season. It just didn't work out in the second half of this game.
All right. Well, we will have plenty on the Giants during the offseason. We'll have months and months to talk about the Giants and everyone's offseason deeds and what they do or what they will have done come summer.
Number three.
But for now, let's move on to topic three, and that is the Pittsburgh Steelers' role against the Dolphins at home. This one, I mean, it started as badly as it could possibly start for the Dolphins, and not just because they were down 14-0, but because, you know, they were giving up huge plays. On top of that, you know, this is a team with a number two quarterback in there. They rely heavily on the run game and Jay Ajayi, and they just never really got a chance to get it established.
Yeah, it was a bad start. But the biggest part of the game came at the end of the first half, beginning of the second half, because Miami was down, what was it, 20-6 at the time?
Yep.
And they got the James Harrison sack fumble. Brandon Albert made a protection mistake on a very basic, it was just a total brain fart. There was nothing disguised, nothing complex about it. He just blocked the wrong guy, and James Harrison made him pay for that. Matt Moore also had, and the announcers didn't talk about this, but Matt Moore had the ball in one hand away from his body as he was eluding the rush, which is, that's literally how they teach you exactly not to do it. You want the ball up and tight by your chest. So the ball security was a problem, and then they had the sack fumble to open the next half, and so that's a big swing in points. I mean, they were moving the ball pretty well at that point, and they had a chance to make it a one-score game right in the middle of the game. That would have changed the whole tenor of how this one unfolded.
Yeah. Now, this was, it almost looked like Moore kind of had no idea that Harrison was as close behind them as he was on that play.
Which is why they teach you to keep two hands on the ball, by the way.
Yeah.
That's why you're taught that don't ever take the second hand off the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, there was Ben was good early in this one. They got the long touchdown to Antonio Brown. He was a little bit shaky as it went on. I mean, he had that one play. It's probably the most ridiculous play of the first half when he, you know, Earl Mitchell dropped the defensive line into a little short zone, and Ben threw it off his chest so hard. I think Earl Mitchell has the Duke tattooed on his left shoulder at this point, and thing goes straight up in the air and falls into Jesse James's hands. And Ben got picked off a couple plays later. But yeah, I know they're a little bit shorter on weapons. You know, no Bryant and Sammy Coates hasn't really been relied on in the passing game with his, with a hand injury and all that. But, it's sort of Le'Veon Bell or, you know, an erratic Roethlisberger if you're picking your poison here with the Steelers.
Well, he needs to clean that up, and the concern, and he'll get it cleaned up, because that Mitchell play, the interception a few plays later, came on the same coverage call as the Mitchell play, and what Miami was doing was checking to an eight-man coverage when the Steelers were in empty formation. So Miami saw nobody in the backfield, and a lot of times teams will call a check when they see that, and they'll either check to a blitz or they'll check to everybody back in coverage, and that's how Miami chose to play it, everybody back in coverage, and Roethlisberger did not handled that well. They'll adjust that. That's something you watch on film Monday morning. They'll have that fixed by Wednesday afternoon in Pittsburgh. He needs to just make better decisions with the football. I would trust him to do that. I mean, he's still a veteran QB, still Ben Roethlisberger. It's not like we have a discipline issue with him. But I'm with you on that, Gary. It was a little bit of a discouraging performance in the second half, late second half, fourth quarter. Their passing game kind of sputtered a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of the Bud Dupree hit on Matt Moore?
I thought it was a good hit. Probably shouldn't lead with your head, though. I thought it was a good hit. Not a dirty hit, certainly. Not the fundamentally soundest hit, because they're emphasizing don't lower your helmet, and he did that.
Yeah.
So I get that. I get the flag. I agree with it. I thought the whole thing went out the way it ought to go out. And I don't think anybody, next time you tell Dupree, you got to keep your face mask up. But
yeah.
I understand that Moore was outside the pocket. It was late in the down. Bud Dupree, by the way, has made a number of big plays late in the down this season. He's been the longer the down goes, the more monstrous Bud Dupree seems to get. And that was the greatest illustration we've seen so far.
Yeah. I was hoping you would hot take that hit and then we could talk about it. But yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I do wish they'd legislate that out, the basically spearing with your helmet. I know there's rules against it, and we saw it in the Jordy Nelson hit. It's just not enforced that often. But yeah, I wish they'd bring back that sort of the emphasis on the spearing rule. But yeah, not a dirty play, but certainly a dangerous one. My favorite play from this game, though. My favorite play was Tony Lopette jumping over trying to block the field goal on 4th and 3, and he just came so early.
Yeah, those plays make highlight reels when they're done on time, but when they're done, you know, I don't know, what about a day and a half before the snap takes place,
yeah,
then it's very bad. And that was a bad penalty too, because that was that extended a drive at the worst possible time. But you could argue, Gary, Pittsburgh jumped out and they were tremendous those first three drives. They threw the ball well the first two drives, and then they ran it 8 times in a row, much like the Buffalo game, and destroyed Miami on the third drive. But you could argue from then on out, the Dolphins lost this game more than the Steelers won this game.
I think that's fair.
Number 4.
And with that, let's move on to topic 4, because it really was as discouraging as the first quarter was. I mean, it was a fairly encouraging game for the Dolphins, and really it was an encouraging season for them. And I guess the big question will be, what do they do at quarterback here? Do you stick with, obviously Matt Moore is not the guy, but do you stick with Ryan Tannehill?
Well, I would be shocked if they don't stick with Ryan Tannehill. I thought he was what you'd want to see and made progress under Adam Gase in year one. I would absolutely stick with Ryan Tannehill.
All right. What do you do? What do they have to do this offseason, Andy?
They need to get better on defense, and specifically, I think, at the linebacker position. And maybe having Jelani Jenkins healthy for the whole year, which has not been the case this season, maybe that'll help him. That'll be enough. But Kiko Alonso, to me, is really – he's an interesting player. He has NFL quality, big-time quality traits in certain areas, but his weaknesses are so – his strengths are very dynamic, and his weaknesses are very glaring, and I don't know what you do with a guy like that. He's not a good in-the-box player. He is dynamic in coverage if he's the aggressor, kind of like Landon Collins, only much worse. Mm-hmm. But if he has to react to things, if he has to read and process information, then he's been a liability in coverage. So really, and what we're talking, that's a replaceable guy. It doesn't have to be replaced. If you put better players around him, you're probably fine with Alonso. But if he's your best linebacker, you've got a problem. And they had a problem all season long at that position. I would fix that defense right up the middle at linebacker. Pick any of the spots. They probably need 2 or 3 new linebackers, in fact.
Yeah. Vance Joseph obviously is going to be a head coaching candidate. He's interviewing a couple places, and we will see if they get to sort of keep that thing going there. You like Vance Joseph, right?
I do like Vance Joseph, yeah. I think he's well-respected around the league. Coaches like him, which my guess is he probably – it's interesting because this defense really wasn't great this season. In fact, I think it set the franchise record for yards allowed. And yet Vance Joseph's stock has risen. And I don't quite know how to reconcile that. My guess is he's considered a very good teacher. He's a defensive backs guy. And the secondary did play well. And I bet he's kind of like Mike Zimmer, who's one of the best technician teachers. He teaches you how to play press, here's your footwork. He's a really hands-on coach like that. I bet Vance Joseph is that way, because as just a schemer, his defense was fine this year, but it's not like we're watching the Spagnuolo Giants here in Miami.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, we talked about their corners. Tony Lopez, this guy, he was a wide receiver at Michigan State 2 seasons ago. Byron Maxwell, obviously, he was a reclamation project. Those are two usable players now. Those are two starting caliber players that they have now.
Yeah, and their second round rookie Xavier Howard was pretty good once he came back from injury down the stretch too.
Yeah.
So, I'd be curious to learn more about Vance Joseph. I'd like to see him stay a defensive coordinator another year or two, just to have a coaching identity carved out a little sharper. That's more for me than for him.
Okay. All right. Well, before we jump into the Saturday games, just a quick note. Perhaps you have made your New Year's resolutions and you are deciding whether to stick with them or not, but this is the year you should do it. You should finally subscribe to this show, the 10 Things Podcast. And if you subscribe on iTunes, please leave a review. That's a wonderful thing for us. And don't you want to help Andy and I? Isn't that a nice thing? When you leave reviews, it helps other people find the show. And that's, we love our listeners and we hope we can get more listeners. So please leave a review. And, if you don't already, please subscribe. That was a very feeble plea. But I guess maybe that makes you think that we need it even more.
We've got a very good Thursday show that comes up now that we enjoy doing. So it's really more of a 20 Things podcast over the course of the week. It's a full slate.
And with the lightning round?
Okay.
The 40-minute lightning round we do?
That's out. There are no more lightning rounds left cuz the regular season's over.
we're going to do a light I guess it's not. No, we're not going to brand it that way. We'll get to topic 9 and we'll tell you what we're going to do there.
Number 5.
But for now, we will go into topic 5 because that is the way numbers work. 5 comes after 4, and this is the Seahawks win over the Lions. And this one, I think, you sort of mentioned how the game sort of went as expected. I think this one went as expected as any game this weekend, and it was sort of like you just watch this and you thought, there's no way this is going to go the Lions' way. Even when the game was a one possession game, when it was 13-6, it was kind of like, it's just not going to happen. Something crazy is going to have to happen. Russell Wilson's going to have to, fumble a snap and kick it out of the end zone or something like that. But
well, even that would only make it 13-8.
Yeah. And then, at least they would have covered if it was a 5-point game. But, I don't know. I mean,
it went exactly as expected on the side of the ball of Lions offense, Seahawks defense. We thought that Seattle would challenge those Lions wide receivers. They did. The Lions wide receivers didn't win. We waited for that to become an issue all season long. We thought it might become an issue down the stretch, and that's exactly what happened. But Matt Stafford had the finger injury, but also in those 4 out of 5 games that they lost late in the year, their wide receivers didn't step up, and that was a problem against better defenses, especially this one. The other side of the ball was a little more interesting, though, because Seattle's offensive line dominated Detroit's defensive line, and Detroit's defensive line had a size advantage going in. So that part of it did surprise me a little bit, but we've seen games this season where Seattle's offensive line, and we haven't figured out the pattern or how this happens. Maybe it's something worth looking at, but there's been a few times where the whole line has just come to life, and all the young guys look like everything you could want them to be, and that was one of those nights on Saturday night. They could very well fall on their face next week because we've seen them do that too after coming to life, but Saturday night against Detroit, they were a dominant front five.
Yeah, I mean, Thomas Rawls had a huge night, and obviously he is the, he's the Marshawn Lynch Jr. in that offense when they go with that identity. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like Haloti Ngata has been sort of hanging on by a fingernail the last couple of games, and I thought they were kind of ripe for this.
I don't think people are surprised. It's not like it's a dominant Lions run defense, but it was a dominant Seahawks offensive line Saturday, and that's the surprise.
All right. You know who I like on that line? And I've brought him up in the show at least one other time because I feel like I'm the only person in America who is obsessed with Mark Lewinsky.
Chris Collinsworth. Collinsworth seemed pretty high on Glowinski too.
I was really happy to see him get highlighted the other night because the Seahawks are on all the time too, and you just never hear his name. But yeah, I remember him back at West Virginia.
Didn't we talk Mark Glowinski at length like 5 times over the offseason where neither of us had ever seen him play?
Oh, I had seen him play at West Virginia all the time, but he, you know, I was kind of like, I think this guy is going to be good, but I really don't know offensive line play well enough to actually make that claim with any sort of boldness. Yeah. I make few claims with any sort of boldness, but yeah, I'm proud of myself because I know inside I really felt like he was going to be a good player, and he had one good game, so now I'm really patting myself on the back.
Well, they've got a chance to build on something here, too. We'll talk about it Thursday, but that's not a great Falcons defensive line that they're going up against. It has potential flashes for greatness with Beasley and Grady Jarrett at nose, but it's all in all, snap to snap, it's not a particularly great defensive line either. So a chance to really build and have two good weeks in a row here.
Yeah. Well, of course, we will talk about that one in the Thursday show, the Look Ahead podcast. But right now, let's go on to topic number six.
Number six.
And that is the Detroit Lions and their future. I'll start with this, Andy, because I was kind of amused when I saw this late in the year, like early December, when all these reports came out saying, like, you know, if the Lions... let the division slip away, Jim Caldwell is out, and then it was sort of like, oh, if the Lions, if they don't win a playoff game, Jim Caldwell might be out. I don't know. I see no reason to make any move. I know Caldwell's a little bit prickly with the media, and I don't know if that sort of plays into all of this, but you know, this team isn't ready to win a playoff game against a really good opponent.
Not quite. Yeah, they didn't beat a playoff team all season long. Which we could look at that as a negative, and sure, that is a negative, but we could also look at that as at least an indication that they took care of business, that they played up to their potential and beat the teams they were supposed to beat, because they beat enough of those teams to make the postseason. If somebody said to you, there's a head coach who he's been a head coach, he was a 3 years at a previous stop and 3 years here and at his new stop, and at the first stop he had a Super Bowl appearance, and at the new stop he's made the playoffs 2 out of 3 seasons on a team that had not gone anywhere for many decades, you'd say that's a great head coach. That's the guy you want to lock up. And by the way, he won a Super Bowl as an offensive play caller late in the season in between that in 2012 in Baltimore. The guy we're talking about is Jim Caldwell. So I don't understand why his name surfaces to the hot seat, other than he appears to have the personality of an armchair or something like that. But he's been a successful coach at multiple places with multiple different types of teams now several times.
Yeah, I don't know. I just I don't get it. I kind of got it from the standpoint of, you know, you have a new GM in there, Bob Quinn. Started this past season, but from all reports, Quinn and Caldwell get along well, and Quinn is not looking to make a change. I'm just shocked that so many people are sort of calling for this to happen.
Well, what could happen, what we've seen more and more, and it'll be interesting if it starts impacting the way coaches choose who coordinates for their offense and defense, like especially if it's a defensive coach, who he picks as his offensive coordinator. Jim Bob Cooter is going to become a hothead coaching candidate at some point, and probably very soon. He's not that yet. He's not that right now. There are a number of really good offensive coaches in the market this season, but he's going to be that soon, and Caldwell's contract is nearing its end. So maybe we see a Dirk Cutter situation, a Ben McAdoo type situation. I could see that coming into play, and if they have to do that, if they risk losing Bob Cooter, Jim Bob Cooter, I guess his last name's Cooter, if they risk losing Coach Cooter, I never know where his first and last names begin and end, but if they risk losing Cooter, then maybe they have to make that tough decision to replace Caldwell with their own offensive coordinator at some point.
It's J. M. Bob Cooter is the entire last name. I mean, the Lions, they personnel-wise, they need better weapons. I mean, they need someone who, in a game against the Seattle Seahawks, can beat press coverage.
I agree with that. I agree. They need they've got the offensive line well addressed. Now, the young guys they have in there need to keep improving, but they've made the investments at the position. They need a difference-making wide receiver. I think Marvin Jones is a number two. I think Golden Tate's a number three. So I guess we would think they need a number one wide receiver, which is the irony of that is that we kind of all agreed they had one, and we agree that they got better without him too, because Calvin Johnson, when he left, it changed the way Matthew Stafford played. they don't need Calvin Johnson's like a number one plus. Like he's his own kind of, like he's in that top five receiver category where he redefines a whole offense. They don't need that, but they need Jordy Nelson type. They need a good solid number one.
And it's also kind of like, you know, they were better without Calvin Johnson this year. We talked about that, but they, you know, they also faced a lot of teams that couldn't take advantage of the fact that they didn't have guys who could beat press coverage, and now that they matched up with a team that could do it, and a lot of the good defense can, you know, this was the result.
But, and by the way, their pass defense, because Lions fans might be listening, saying, "Hey, we gave up an NFL record 72.7, I think it was almost 73% completion rate." That's bizarre to me because that was a good secondary. It was an above-average secondary. It was a decent pass rush, too. It wasn't consistent enough in the pass rush. But I guess to just sum it up, don't let the numbers fool you on that. That's a total aberration. Put on the film each week, and it was a well-put-together, well-executed secondary. I think they're fine at that spot.
Would you say they need help up the middle, or is that just a, I don't know, is that just a reaction to what happened on Saturday night?
Are you talking about up at what level? At linebacker, safety, or
no? At middle of the defensive line and at linebacker.
A'shaun Robinson's a guy they drafted in the second round last season, so
he's really young too.
And he got he improved over the course of the year. So let's keep that in mind. Haloti Ngata, maybe you do replace him. I like their backups. I like Kyrie Thornton. I like Tyrone Walker. So I guess to answer your question, Gary, if the right guy is there, if they fall in love with someone and they have a chance to take them, they can do it. But I don't see it as a dire need that they absolutely have to go out and address over the offseason. Okay. I think they got outplayed by an inferior group of talent in Seattle Saturday night. And let's keep in mind, that was one game.
All right. Fair enough.
Number seven.
Well, let's go on to topic number seven, which is the last game of Wild Card Weekend. It was the first one that happened, and it was the one that everyone pointed and laughed at, and it was that kind of game. The Texans did beat the Oakland Raiders. It became abundantly clear very early on that the Raiders were not going to be able to do much of anything on offense with Connor Cook back there. It did not help that Donald Penn was out for this game, and Menelik Watson was immediately torched by Jadeveon Clowney, and it was kind of like, you know, This is just not going to go well.
Oh, it couldn't have gone. The circumstances could not have been worse. You have a rookie QB who's never played. It's a somewhat of a short week. It's a Saturday game, so not a Sunday. That matters if you're learning to play for the first time. You're learning a game plan as a starter for the first time. You have a left tackle, as you said, getting your backup right tackle basically plays left tackle. And he goes up against a guy who I thought should have been all pro this season. It's on the road, and then it's against a defense that's been number one in the league because they've been so good at disguising coverages. So there's no you have no chance in that case. It didn't work out. The only time they got rolling a little bit in Oakland was when the Texans backed off and kind of simplified what they were doing, trading yards for time is what we call that in football. And the Raiders, he got going then because he started seeing coverages he's seen before. But when they were giving them the full Texans treatment, it's not fair to him to try to compete. They were in an untenable position there. It's very unfortunate, but that's how it goes, as they say.
Yeah. And look, unfortunately, it sort of, you know, it sparked that next round of everyone saying, oh, Cowboys wanted Connor Cook, Raiders could have had Dak Prescott and that sort of thing. I'm not sure there's a rookie quarterback on the planet under these circumstances who basically spent an entire season as the number three guy, as the scout team guy, and you know, got elevated to number two for week 17 and then had to go out there on the road in a postseason game with his first start. That's, no one's going to win that game.
Yeah, Prescott would have had a tough time in that situation as well. He probably would have given them more of a chance. But now or he could have not at all, because he probably, right, you're exactly right, Gary. He maybe would have been the third stringer, and now he's not Dak Prescott as we know him. So there are no butterfly effects in the NFL. And as far as Houston goes, they go on against New England. Now, I thought Osweiler played pretty well for them. It wasn't great in the second half, but was, you know where he was best, Gary? And we've seen this a few times this season, in that 2-minute drive at the end of the first half. That's and he started off with a nice throw to Hopkins, and that got him rolling. There was a decisiveness to him. He has been a robotic QB at times, as we've talked about. He's not a tight window thrower, but there have been times this season where it's late in the game or it's late in the half, and the situation demands that you play that way. You have to play that way, and so therefore the risk of playing that way, kind of the pressure comes off. There's no downside because you have to play that way. You have to throw tight windows in 2 minutes, and he's been pretty good when he's had to play that way at times.
Yeah, well, they came out and did a little bit of no huddle early on in this. I, you know, my only criticism of the Texans, and you can't criticize them that much for this game because they ended up winning comfortably, but I thought they had a couple opportunities early on where they sort of had foot on the throat of the Raiders, and they played it a little more conservative than I would have liked to see, but who cares what I think. But
I thought that too. They've done that all season long. There was the most obvious one was the third down and four. I believe they ran the ball at midfield on third and four.
Yeah.
Which that's just as conservative as you can get. Play, and it wasn't just that they ran, it was like they ran power. It was like a straight handoff up the middle. And I get if it works, we're not talking about it, so I understand that. But they've hidden their quarterback and their play calling on third down a lot this season, and they continue to do that in this game. But I also understand that they played against an offense, a Raiders offense, that they knew couldn't score against them. So if you're playing field position, that's appropriate. If they do that next week at New England, that's not going to be appropriate.
Well, they will go on to New England. That will be the Saturday night game, and Let's take a little look at the Raiders here and what they are going into this offseason. That is topic number 8.
Number 8.
You know, you got to feel good if you're a Raiders fan. I mean, obviously the season did not end the way you wanted it to, but realistically, was this team, even with Derek Carr, what were the odds they were going to go to Foxborough at some point and beat the Patriots? Probably not really good. Possible, but certainly not not very good odds. But look, they pretty much have their offense in place. I'd ask about the secondary. They brought in a lot of new pieces this year, and you had two new safeties. Do you think this is something that gets better just with the continuity? I mean, obviously everything gets better with a little more continuity, but individual talent looks like it's all right. Can they sort of make a significant step up in their second year together?
That's a really good question. It's a good question because they run the Seahawks-style scheme at times, but they also run the Del Rio Broncos-style scheme, which is to say they play basic man or basic zone coverage. Mm-hmm. And which is fine. That's an execution-based approach. They have Khalil Mack and they have Bruce Irvin. They'll have Aldon Smith next year, so they've got guys who can rush the passer, so you can be very basic in your coverages. And it's reasonable to think they will be better on the back end. Carl Joseph's a rising first-round rookie this season. They had issues at inside linebacker that started to get figured out. I'll be interested to see what they feel about Malcolm Smith. I don't know his contract situation, but just if that's the guy for them or if they're going to go out and find an inside linebacker. I would imagine they'll try to find at least one. The other concern is at the slot position. TJ Carey's a fine slot corner. I don't think DJ Hayden's a quality NFL slot corner, and my guess is a change will be made there if they get the right opportunity. They don't have guys that cover great in space. They have corners and Smith and Amerson who are good along the boundary, but where this team gets in trouble and where Osweiler, not by coincidence, threw the ball predominantly, especially early in the game where you are executing your game plan, was between the field numbers, working those linebackers and working the slot receivers. That's where Osweiler's most comfortable, tight ends, DeAndre Hopkins in the slot, but that's also where Oakland has been weakest in pass defense this season.
And I want to ask about Amari Cooper. I think we all agree Amari Cooper is a good to very good player. I think everyone was sort of expecting that step up to sort of superstar status this year. A guy who you'd put in the conversation as being one of the best 5 or 10 receivers in football. He didn't get there. And look, he was not a factor in this loss on Saturday. Really wasn't a factor down the stretch either a whole lot. He had a nice contested catch at the end of week 16 from McGloin. He caught a long touchdown from Cook in the Denver game, but he just disappeared for long stretches.
He did.
Are you wringing your hands at all when you think about Amari Cooper?
I'm not quite going that far, but I am looking at it closely because he tailed off as a rookie as well in the second half of that season. The first half of this season, I thought he did show big time. I had him all pro midseason. And his route running patience always jumps off the screen. He looks like the Le'Veon Bell of route runners when he gets early into his breaks, coming off the line and setting up his breaks. So the foundation's there. A guy like this should be producing more. I don't know why he didn't produce in the second half of the season. I don't know if he could tell you that. I don't know if Del Rio or coordinator Bill Musgrave or Derek Carr could tell you that. But it's happened two seasons in a row now.
Crabtree, I don't know.
By the way, Crabtree dropped too many balls. Both of these guys, they've got really skilled receivers who don't catch the ball very well. And that's strange to see. And Crabtree has some of the best hands in the league at times. I mean, he makes stick-em catches, and yet he led the NFL in drops this season too.
Yep.
And both
he had a
of these guys
bad
are,
ones on Saturday.
He did, yeah. These are great route-running receivers who don't play consistently or up to the consistency that their talent level suggests they should.
All right. Well, like I said, you got to feel pretty good about the future if you are a Raiders fan. You figure this is a team that is going to be in the AFC West conversation every year and probably make playoffs most of the for most of the next decade or so.
Don't you see everybody and their brother picking this team next year for the Super Bowl under the logic of, wow, if they'd had Derek Carr, then they probably would have been in it. They're going to be the hot, trendy pick for Super Bowl next season. Don't bet on them just because everybody else will as well.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, that'll be interesting to see when Super Bowl 52 odds come out. We will have to talk about that since we are apparently gambling addicts on this show right now.
Well,
even though you and I don't bet on football.
Yeah, we've been talking about
it
a lot.
I mean, look, the AFC is, outside of the Patriots, the AFC is wide open. So I don't think there's going to be
I'd
anything.
I'd say outside of the Patriots and Steelers and Chiefs, too. I'd say outside of the teams that are left in the play. It's a pretty good conference.
I don't know. I'd put the Patriots on, I'd put the Patriots on the sort of the first tier there, and then I'd put Steelers, Chiefs, and I'd probably put Raiders with a fully healthy team right there with the Steelers and the Chiefs.
Yeah, well, that's so you just agreed with me.
Yeah, but I'm saying the Patriots are above those other teams.
Okay, all right, but
I'm not saying
those
literally
are
wide open. I'm not predicting a Cleveland Browns Super Bowl in 2017, but it's kind of like you look at the Patriots and you say, oh, as long as Brady's going to be doing his thing, and there's no reason to think he's not going to do his thing next year, everyone's sort of playing for second place.
And we're kind of being a little bit prisoner of the moment here, too, because we're talking about the three teams that are left, plus Houston, and then we're talking about the one team that everybody agreed would have been on par with those three teams and competing with them if their quarterback had stayed healthy.
Yeah.
So maybe we're just recapping this postseason here.
I know. I'm just reading the standings here.
Yeah.
All right, let's go on to topic number 9. This is normally the lightning-ish round, and we don't have enough topics to do a lightning round. It would be a really fast round if we only talked about two things and just moved on. But
number 9.
There is one thing that happened in the league that we wanted to address, and that is Greg Williams is on as the Cleveland Browns' new defensive coordinator, sort of dashing Sean Payton's fantasy of taking the Rams job and then day one dramatically firing Greg Williams. It's just not going to happen. Maybe Sean Payton's going to start lobbying for that Browns job. But yeah, Williams to Cleveland. Andy, what do you think of this move?
I think a lot of people are saying, ooh, that's bizarre. The Browns are switching from a 3-4 to a guy who runs a 4-3. I don't look at it that way. That stuff gets way overblown. The whole 3-4-4-3 teams change up their fronts so often, they're not looking at it that way. And as long as you have Danny Shelton, you can run either one of those two because he can play in either scheme. And really the difference in a 3-4 and a 4-3 is how you use your nose tackle. Is he one gap or is he two gaps? So I don't mind that at all. Greg Williams, I thought, had an up and down season in Los Angeles. He had a lot of talent to work with, and he did a good job of using that talent. I thought there were times you could say they maybe got a little too cute in some of the things they did or aggressive at weird times and not aggressive at other times. Like the end of the Niners game, for example, they were not aggressive. They went very basic zone, and their corners play with a lot of cushion, and Kaepernick sliced them up down the field, Colin Kaepernick. So I didn't think it was a great year for Greg Williams, but I like him as a D coordinator. I do think he's long time been one of the best in the NFL, so I'll be cautiously optimistic on the Browns' behalf here.
All right. Fair enough.
Ray Horton's available now, too. That's Ray Horton's out there. And his stock was so high in Arizona. He was great and regarded as great. His blitz packages, especially near the red zone as the Cardinals' defensive coordinator, were outstanding. And then he went to Cleveland under Chudzinski and got caught up in that where everyone got fired after 1 year. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of cycled around a little bit. He went to Tennessee and lost the job to LeBeau, and now he's out in 1 year in Cleveland again.
That was that weird year in Tennessee where they brought LeBeau in and basically had LeBeau and Horton on the staff. It was, he's had a weird little journey here.
He has. I don't know why that is, what's going on, but it started in Cleveland and it's now ended in Cleveland. Two different coaching staffs, 1 year stints. And who hires Ray Horton? So I think he didn't forget how to coach all of a sudden. So the guy that was doing good work in Arizona when he had Patrick Peterson in a corner he could rely on, that guy still exists somewhere in the league. So I would imagine someone's going to want to hire him.
Yep. Well, let's wrap up topic 9. We are going to take a quick look ahead to next weekend's games. We will obviously on the Thursday show have the deep dive on all 4 divisional round matchups. But Andy, what are you most looking forward to next weekend?
I like those Sunday games, the Chiefs and Steelers and Cowboys, Packers. Those were mid-season. Those are mid-season games. So rematches. Those teams played back around Halloween, if I recall, plus or minus Halloween. I like that. I always find that fun. For one, it kind of makes my job easier because I can go back and just read those film notes and build my articles around that. But I like to see how teams have evolved and what they'll do. And it's a different Steelers defense than what Kansas City saw that night. And it's a different Packers offense than what Dallas saw that Sunday afternoon.
Yep. Now, I'm looking forward to seeing that Atlanta Seahawks rematch. How good are these Falcons going to be moving the ball? They did it out in Seattle, and they did it when Earl Thomas was healthy.
Yeah.
I think if you're a Falcons fan, I know the Seahawks have the pedigree, and they've made the runs, but, I'd feel pretty good about this one.
Yeah, and I forgot that you're right. Those games, the other two games were rematches earlier, too. They were just much earlier in the season. The Patriots and the Texans played that Thursday night game. It was the Jacoby Brissett game, so you probably throw that one aside, at least on that side of the ball. But, yeah, you're right. That Falcons-Seahawks game, Atlanta's O versus Seattle's D, that was the most fun film I watched all season long. So I wished I'd answered the way you did, because that's another one that's a great – and what's also interesting there is these are not different defenses and offenses than before. They're more of who they already were. So we're going to see how they've evolved within their own schemes. Really, we're going to see who's gotten better. And I think Atlanta's going to be a tall order for Seattle there.
Yeah. No, those were – that Atlanta game, the Seahawks were blowing coverages as bad as you can blow coverages. And, that was with a Sherman blow up on the sideline, and, that's fine. But obviously, the Falcons did things that really frustrated the Seahawks defense. So that'll be –
they did. The Falcons coaxed them into blowing the coverages. And we'll talk about that more on Thursday. It wasn't just that Seattle walked out there and put their thumbs up themselves. It was that Atlanta really schemed well and put those guys in tough spots mentally, and they blew the coverage because of it.
Oh, that is that is quite the saying, Andy.
Number 10.
And with that, we will shut down topic 9 and move on to topic 10. This is our weekly awards. Let's kick it off with Offensive Player of the Week. Andy, would you like to go first?
I would, because I want to claim Aaron Rodgers. Nothing to say. I mean, you don't need me to tell you anything. From a physical standpoint, just physical standpoint, he's quarterbacking the best I've ever seen right now. Mentally, we always can debate, and he's a different kind of quarterback mentally. That's probably because physically he's playing the best I've seen the position be played.
That Hail Mary was incredible. Have you ever seen a Hail Mary that was caught with that much room on the back line, and it, you know, Kopp didn't even have to reach up for it. It just, he caught it in his belly.
It's almost like he had like ball placement on it. Like he placed
with
the
like
ball.
A full yard to spare.
He's good at that. And what he understands, and the other guy who's really good on deep balls has been Tyrod Taylor this year. Not a Hail Mary, but the reason that these guys are good, it's the same kind of thing. The amount of air that you get under your deep ball, that really matters in correlation to the throw. And Taylor was great because he can throw the ball 60 yards downfield, but it feels like 80 because it takes longer to get there. That's what you need to do on a Hail Mary. That's what Rodgers is so good at as well, getting air under the ball. The appropriate amount of air. His touchdown to Davante Adams was a go route, and he threw kind of on a rope. It was a very low arcing ball. That's another example, getting the right air under the ball. Totally different type of throw, much less air. But his command right now of throwing and how he's placing the throws and the way he's getting the energy behind them, it's absolutely perfect right now.
Mm-hmm. I'll give it to Le'Veon Bell then. For basically shutting the door on this one. Second quarter on, he pretty much owned this game. Ended up 29 carries, 167 yards in the Steelers' victory. Who do you have for Defensive Player of the Week, Andy?
I'm going to split it between two guys. Bobby Wagner, but did you see how many all-pro votes he got, by the way? He got 46 out of 50 votes.
Wow. I was going to say, I actually saw none of the All-Pro stuff. I don't know how I missed it. I just didn't go out of my way to look it up.
All right. I think I'm remembering that. If I'm not, tweet at us. I know you will, and tell me I'm wrong. But I believe he got 46 votes All-Pro. I'm going to go him. He did a great job against delay tactics, the screen game against Detroit. He was very good. He's been good at that all season long. One of the reasons he is because in their man-to-man coverage concepts, he always takes the running back. So screen passes, he's going to have a little bit of a beat on those because if they're in man coverage, he had his eyes on the running back to begin with anyway. So he saw the screen coming. The other guy I'm going to go is James Harrison. They brought him along slowly to save him for this time of the year. The plan has paid off perfectly. He's playing every single snap, and he's playing it at an extremely high level, mostly on run defense more than against the pass, and that's what we saw against Miami.
Yeah. I'll give it to JV and Clowney. Didn't see a whole lot of resistance in that game on Saturday, but, you know, he dominated early on, and it was kind of just set the tone, kind of just sent the message that Raiders just weren't going to score enough points in this one. Andy, who is your special teams player of the week?
Lippitt, Miami, the guy that stood out, the one I noticed.
He did stand out, didn't he?
Yeah. Well,
he
jumped off the screen
by the
way. Game.
Yeah. I hate that play. I hope they get rid of it. I mean, it's neat to see, but it's like we've seen it enough already, so it's not surprising anymore. But it's a dangerous play. I hope they outlaw it. Or if they don't,
Let me ask you this: Who's it dangerous for?
I think it's dangerous for the guy leaping if he mistimes it a little bit and that lineman comes up or the center comes up. I think it's dangerous for the center if you, if you come up a little short on that leap.
You come right down on the center.
Or I mean, you have a guy. I would say it's more dangerous for the leaper. Because, you know, if you get sort of knocked off balance, if you clip someone on the way over, you know, you're going
head
over heels.
That's true of any time you jump in football. So, I mean, that's true if you're going to jump for a high ball over the middle or along the sideline or whatever.
No, but you're usually not jumping over a person who's going to be rising up. They're not going to outlaw running backs hurdling people, so... But, you know, it's that type of danger. I think it's more dangerous to the hurdler, but it's also dangerous to the center. That's why you're not supposed to be running into that guy.
I know there are like three or four special teams plays over the last few years that, for one, the reason I don't watch these is because 95% of them get flags anyway. It's just a flag fest on these special teams plays. But the ones I remember are always these leaping ones. Remember the Cam Chancellor one over Carolina?
It was cool. That was the first time we saw it. It was like, whoa, do you see what Cam did? And now it's kind of like, oh, yeah, they're doing that again. It's played out.
Now I am.
It's stale.
I am doubling down on Lippitt now because not only was it a great play. Now, granted, he was way too soon because nobody else was playing yet. But it was a courageous play because of the high risk apparently that he put himself at.
And not to mention, are you gonna get like Richard Sherman type guys who are gonna leap and then they're gonna dive at the kicker and touch the
ball?
Well,
that's a separate issue. I mean, okay, what if we get some guy that one day leaps and then grips the kicker's helmet off and beats him with it? I mean, I get, like, anything could happen after these leaps. You're surmising stuff here.
Oh, man. I'm going to do a – there's going to be a Law & Order spinoff. Law & Order leaping the center. And it's going to be a bunch of my fictional accounts of the horrible things that happen to people when they leap over the center.
Who's your special teams guy?
I'll give it to Matt Prater because he kicked two long field goals, and that was the only thing that was keeping that game interesting. I also enjoyed Eddie Pleasant scooping up that bounced muffed punt by Tyler Irvin.
Okay.
But that
good.
Was it.
So, all right.
Pleasant plunged the runner up. Matt Prater gets
Pleasant's the runner up. And I'll say about Pleasant, he's been very good in their dime packages this season as a blitzer and as a tight end defender. And that's all I know about him. I don't know him on special teams.
Who's your coach of the week, Andy?
My coach of the week. You know what? Why don't we go? George Gotze's had a tough year in Houston. Mm-hmm. Because there's this perception that he was stripped of his play-calling duties. And he, to a certain extent, he was for a little while. Bill O'Brien decided he wanted to take a little more control of that back. We don't know what all goes into that or why, but Gotze's been calling plays a lot lately, so it's not like he's been demoted. He's still a good young offensive coordinator. They haven't had a great scenario to work with there, and they've had to work around that. But I thought they had a solid approach against the Raiders, and the Raiders came out and did stuff that we really haven't seen them do. They were very blitz oriented. They brought guys off the edge and the slot especially, and that never got Houston. They were on top of it. They still played within the context of their scheme. So it was a good solid performance by a coaching staff in Houston there that's been probably criticized a little more than they deserve to be in their market, I'm guessing.
I don't know. Coach of the week was tough this week. Everything just sort of happened the way it was supposed to happen. I'll give it to Chris Richard because he went ahead and sort of smothered the Lions and left no doubt with that one. So he gets it from me.
All right. And they did more man coverage concepts, which has been his staple. He's added more man-to-man in their scheme, and they've responded well. So he's not just inheriting Gus Bradley and Dan Quinn's defense and copying them. He's kind of grown it into what he wants it to be, and we'll see how that works out now that he plays against a team that knows him real well here in Atlanta next week.
That's right. Well, we will, of course, have the full deep dive on that game on the Thursday Look Ahead podcast, but that is going to do it for this show. Thank you, as always, to producer Matt Havia and editor Chris Basil, all those guys over there at Digital Media who make us sound so good. Thank you very much to our researcher, Jeff Irwin. Most of all, thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We, of course, have the mailbag on Thursday. Send your questions. They can be about the games. They can be about the offseason, coaches, draft, free agency, anything that pops into your head. Just send it along. You can get Andy on Twitter at Andy_Benoit. You can get me at GGrambling_SI. We're both on Facebook. Facebook's great. Write as long as you want. There's also the email talkback@themmqb.com. Just put podcast somewhere in your email. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys on Thursday.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team. Every day.